From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we rebroadcast some great conversations with two great artists and thinkers. Later in the show, jazz musician Christian Scott Atunde Ajua reflects on his personal and musical evolution and discusses his latest project. It's called The Centennial Trilogy. But first, actor John Lithgow is a prolific actor. He most recently won awards for his portrayal of British Prime Minister Winston Churchill in the series The Crown, and the first season of his NBC comedy Trial and Error has just ended. You can catch him on the big screen opposite Salma Hayek in the politically charged dark comedy Beatrice at Dinner. Before our conversation here, a scene now from Beatrice at Dinner.
Well, when I first came to the United States a long time ago...
Did you come legally?
Yes.
Now, how'd that work?
I had family here on my mother's side. My grandmother died and...
And they're all citizens or...
Ah, Doug, what, you work for the INS? You're grilling her.
I'm curious. A lot of people come here illegally. I was interested in how she did it.
I'm laughing already. Because I have seen this, I whispered to you that I have not seen you play a guy who I disliked so much. As much as I love you, Mr. Lithgow, I have not seen you play a guy I dislike so much since maybe Ricochet with Denzel. And then you reminded me that your character in Dexter wasn't the nicest guy.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a full-service entertainer.
Well, you put it to good use in this one, man.
I play the good guys and the bad guys, and most interestingly, the people who fall somewhere in between.
Yeah. What is the joy of playing the bad guys, the mean guys, arrogant guys?
Well, I don't even consider him the bad guy.
Yeah,
when you play this role, you think of him as the righteous one,
mm-hmm.
the one
Fair enough.
He thinks he's right, so you've got to put yourself into that mindset. Mm-hmm. And so does the writer, Michael White.
Mm-hmm.
Mike White, he just sort of, he loves just the curiosity of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And these are complicated times. I mean, this is a complicated villain.
Yeah.
His name is Doug Strutt. He is a billionaire developer.
Strutt's the right name.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got a certain swagger to him.
Yeah.
But he's very comfortable with his own decisions in life. He has no conscience or remorse about anything. Everything is pragmatic with him.
Yeah.
Now, who does this remind you of?
Yeah.
The thing is, it's got, this movie has all the elements of a comedy. It's a mm-hmm. sort of culture clash mm-hmm. story. It's a dinner party among three billionaires and their wives, which by a couple of turns of plot, there is a seventh guest, and this is a poor Mexican immigrant who works as a physical therapist for mm-hmm. the lady of the house. This is Salma Hayek.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, bit by bit, it becomes a dialogue, a sort of debate between my character and Salma's.
The social commentary in this thing is searing
mm-hmm.
by the time this thing starts to turn. When you read this on paper, were you immediately turned on by this? I mean, you saw what it was.
Yeah,
yeah.
I was very turned on.
Yeah, yeah.
You're always turned on by dialogue that's that good, that
yeah, yeah.
has that much crackle to it. I already knew it was Mike's dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
I'd already been in one of his films, a flat-out comedy, mm-hmm. Orange County. And I knew, you know, he's interested in comedy, but he's also interested in much, much broader things.
Mm-hmm.
When he set out to write this, he and Miguel Arteta, the director, who has worked frequently with Mike, they went to Salma and they just presented this as an idea. What if this character, Beatrice, got stuck in a supper party with six wealthy people? What would happen? And they got her excited about the very idea, and 2 weeks later, Mike presented her with a script. He wrote it that quickly.
Mm.
He knows these people. He's very, very interested in tensions between dissimilar people.
Mm-hmm.
And people who come at situations from a completely different direction. And you just radiated. I mean, I read it and I thought, gosh, I really want to do this. It's also a mordant comedy about what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we go through our lives. One of the problems in our lives is that people from different segments of our society just don't communicate with each other, nor do you ever see entertainment where they communicate with each other and mm-hmm. fight with each other. And that's what Mike set out to do. I was just fascinated by that challenge.
Yeah. When you chin checked me as nicely and lovingly as you did a few minutes ago by saying to me, Tavis, I don't see him as the bad guy, uh-huh. I knew immediately where you were going with that, having seen the project, because you're right. In his mind, he isn't the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
He believes what he believes. He isn't shy about expressing his opinions. And so I took your point when you said that. And yet the flip side of that is that that kind of hubris and that kind of arrogance and that kind of elitism, as one sees in this film, is hard to break through. And it makes me wonder how it is that we, in fact, do that in a world where classism is so entrenched. If the people that we're talking about are like the character that you play, and there really just isn't any there to appeal to.
It's very unsettling. It's a troubling film. It's a challenging film in this way. But I think it's very accurate. There are these social enclaves, certain golf courses, certain social clubs, where people have set up sort of battlements around them. You know, there's just no communication with the rest of society. They are a protected breed. It's all almost anthropological, and yet they're human beings. Mm-hmm. You know, they. In doing the film, I was quite surprised and excited by how Miguel, our director, he would direct me to really enjoy himself, genuinely enjoy himself, be very comfortable. He himself was interested in looking around the other side. I mean, of course, particularly liberal film goers already bring all sorts of expectations to this film. They have their point, I should say. Mm-hmm. I'm a liberal Democrat myself.
Mm-hmm.
I know what the vision and the point of view of this film is, and yet Miguel was intent on turning that on its head, on really challenging people. Doug Strutt says some very frightening things, particularly toward the end.
Mm-hmm.
He completely accepts, for example, the fact that the environment is decaying and the earth is doomed. He accepts that. What can you do about it? Enjoy yourself. He says these things and it's heart-stopping because he's going at the things that terrify us most. And yet here's a person who's not afraid of that. Who's, as I say, it's very unsettling stuff.
Mm-hmm. Because, as you said earlier, John, because he and all his cohorts at the dinner table are, in fact, Homo sapiens. They're human beings as well. I have to believe that every human being has a humanity that is worth respecting and maybe even reveling in. No matter how wrong they may be in their political ideology, they do have a humanity that is worth respecting. How did you connect to the humanity in this character?
Through his humor.
Yeah.
I mean, that had a lot to do with it. Through his own enthusiasms. When he talks about big game hunting in Africa, for example, he talks about it with real genuine passion. It's something that really reaches him emotionally. Try to find the things that animate this man and get him excited, make him laugh. It's just what you do when you approach a character. You try to find out what makes him tick. And that's particularly important if you're playing somebody who people already know is the villain purely on the basis of what they've seen in the quotes as you walk into the theater.
Yeah.
It's important to upend that because nobody is the villain in his own story.
I've been around people like this in my lifetime and in my work. And it's so unsettling, and it never ceases to amaze me how people can be so blind to the opinions, the feelings, the worldview, the experiences of others. And this scene you raise now is a powerful example of that. So, as you recall from the film, he passes around his cell phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the picture of his hunting.
His conquest,
perfect word. And when it gets to Beatrice, to Selma Hayek's character, she just unloads on him,
mm-hmm.
and not to give the movie away, throws the phone across the room.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that, and again, I'm not naive in saying this, but the fact that he couldn't even process or see that coming, or just didn't have another way of viewing how somebody else might see his conquest, he's just... It's numbing to me.
But look at how he responds when she throws the phone.
Yeah.
Do you remember his response? He laughs.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, this is great.
Yeah.
The thing is, we all live in our little worlds.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare that people venture out of their world, and we're all subject to groupthink.
Yeah.
As a result. My circle of friends, academics and theatricals, my wife's a professor, many of our friends are simply faculty members at UCLA. We all have more or less the same politics, and we all reinforce each other all the time and
mm-hmm.
go to the same marches and write the same op-ed letters. But it's very, very important to see what in the world is going on the other side of the sort of political divide. It's the most distressing thing about society right now is this huge gulf. None of us can figure out why the other side can possibly be thinking this way.
But how do you do that, John, when by your own admission, in your own, I'm coming away from the film now, to your personal world that you just
mm-hmm.
described. I only go there because you went there. In your own world, when your point of view, right though it may be, is reinforced by your wife and your friends and your colleagues, how do you see the other side? Because now we're back to Strutt in the film, who didn't see another, couldn't appreciate another point of view.
Well, curiously, Doug Strutt does see the other point of view. Or at least he has certainly seen it before.
Yeah.
People have protested.
But he finds it laughable, though.
He dismisses it because he's far, far more powerful than they are, and he knows they can't bend his trajectory at all. He's going to accomplish what he sets out to do because he's done it 100 times before.
Yeah.
He has power, and he has the complacency and smugness of power. But he completely enjoys it. He's a curiously appealing character, just because he's sort of fun to be with. At least this is how Mike has written it and
mm-hmm.
Miguel has directed it. To me, this is what gives the film its terrific tension
mm-hmm.
and makes it so challenging. You know, you've simply got to accept the fact, for example, that our government is doing what it's doing right now because it's happening.
Yeah.
You've got to, I don't know about accept it, but you've got to acknowledge it and figure out ways of resisting it and at least creating a dialogue. I mean, it's a film that creates a conversation, I think.
But when the Strutts of the world run the world, and they have that kind of power, that kind of authority, that kind of control, when they think they are, or in fact appear to be, untouchable. If in fact these are the folk who run the world, what are we to do about that? What agency did Beatrice really have in that scenario?
Well, Beatrice is very heroic
mm-hmm.
and fearless. She just goes ahead and says it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the most important thing, is courage,
mm-hmm.
and to really make very clear to yourself what your convictions are and act on them.
Mm-hmm.
I say that I'm not a particularly courageous person politically myself, but it is time to stand up and say what you believe. In fact, there's a lot of, I think in the midst of this is a very upsetting time. I mean, I read the news every morning and
mm-hmm.
I get in a state of hysteria about the damage that's being done, in my view. But it's also a time of sort of creative ferment, I think, politically. People are rising up. And as soon as this devastating election took place, in my worldview, it was devastating. But the next day, I began to already think, well, this is going to be a good year. This is going to be a great year for Schadenfreude.
because people like this have a self-destructive streak. They tend to destroy the things that they have built up before our very eyes. And we're seeing it. We're seeing it. As I saw it in 1973, the last time I was this obsessed with journalism and what was being written about politics was in the spring of 1973.
Watergate.
When the whole government fell apart because of duplicity and ambition.
John Dean, who was Richard Nixon's White House counsel, as you recall, sat in this very chair some weeks ago. And it was fascinating to have a conversation with John Dean about the parallels as he saw between that Nixonian moment and this Trumpian moment, if I can put it that way. So it's just eerie to hear his sharing of what those comparisons are. Since you remember that period, just as a citizen, does it feel as eerie as icky now as you recall it feeling then to you?
Well, the interesting thing about Watergate was you just felt something's curious here, something's wrong. This isn't quite right. And then suddenly it exploded and this is quite different. Things are happening so fast right before our eyes. Every day something essential that happened in the last 8 years of a very good presidency is being taken away from us. And you're just seeing it happen. Concurrent with that, some scandalous things are coming to light. So there is this kind of hunger for things to move faster. I do believe these scandals are going to bring this administration down. I just want it to happen fast.
Sooner than later.
Yeah.
I've asked this question of others, John, but I'm curious to ask it of you, given the role that you play in this film, and given your earlier comment that you're not particularly politically courageous. I've always known you to be a person, that comment notwithstanding, a person who speaks his own mind on this program and elsewhere. So, what do you see as the role of the citizen artist in this moment? That's what you are. You are a citizen artist. What's the
role?
Well,
you know, Tavis, I did do Beatrice at Dinner. I did The Crown, which I think is a wonderful meditation on leadership and government. But in the middle of all that, I did Trial and Error, Pitch Perfect 3, and Daddy's Home 2. Three pieces of wild nutball entertainment. As I said, I'm a full-service entertainer.
Yes, sir.
My job in life is to delight, excite, sometimes terrify people. Just keep them entertained. It's a wonderful thing when I do something that actually hits the mark, which actually moves the goalpost, moves the chains down the field in terms of expanding people's consciousness. When I did Roberta Muldoon in World According to Garp, when I did Love is Strange with Alfred Molina, when I did M. Butterfly on Broadway, these were all pieces which in their way really jostled people's mindset and expanded people's consciousness. It's a wonderful thing when you can do that as an actor. But you can't make it your main mission. Your main mission is simply do your job, delight people, you know, make them, give them emotional exercise, make them cry, make them laugh, and make them scream out in terror. those are my jobs. And if possible, make them think, but that's not completely necessary.
Yeah. I take all of that, and yet you will never convince me that you did not take or do not take or will not take a particular delight in this film, given the resonance of it in a time such as this.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad. You know, we made this film in September. This was around the time when I saw your great interview with Andrew Sullivan,
who
predicted the results of the presidential election. I watched that and I said, well, that's scary words, Andrew, but don't worry, that's not gonna happen. Well, by the time we had finished the film, they were just finishing the final cut of the film when the election took place. Suddenly, the film suddenly cast a shadow that it didn't have before. it suddenly became a much more provocative film, as provocative as it was.
Yeah.
Because it was really about our moment,
yeah,
our political moment.
So here's the tricky question. So I'm only going to ask it, and you, having started the film and having seen the film, will know how to answer this without giving too much away.
Mm-hmm.
I wrestled with the way that thing ended.
I knew you were going to ask that.
I'm not giving anything away.
No, neither am I.
I'm just saying, John Lithgow, that I wrestled. My spirit was vexed by the way that thing ended. What say you about that?
Well, I say people have got to see this film to see what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's a complicated film. It's a very troubling film. It's a film written by a very funny man about a very serious subject. And you end up with intensely conflicted feelings at the end. And how can you not, when the film is about the things it's about? I agree with you. There are moments in this film that are extremely upsetting. But if you put together this combination of people for an entire evening,
that's what happens,
and watch them drink wine all evening long, and in one case smoke dope,
yeah,
crazy things are going to happen.
The truth can be very unsettling.
Yeah.
And very unhousing. I close on this note. In this moment, this for real moment, off the screen, are you hopeful? And if you are, how do you sustain your hope? What makes you hopeful?
I'm a very hopeful person. I mean, I'm an optimistic person, sometimes stupidly optimistic. I was very I went and voted for Hillary Clinton.
Anyway.
On the morning of November 8th, and I felt like $1 million. Mm-hmm. I felt like I'd voted for the first woman president, and I believed in her as a candidate. And my hopes were dashed. You know, I felt like a fool for being so optimistic. But then I was optimistic again the next day. I don't know, maybe it's just my nature. I am in the business of exploring crazy possibilities. Mm-hmm. I am a storyteller, and the stories I tell are, when I'm lucky, they're really good ones. And it's a very exciting thing to do with your life. Yeah. And that's, I think, is what keeps me hopeful.
Yeah. Well, you're luckier than most.
I know how lucky I am.
I didn't mean like that. You said, when I'm lucky, I tell good stuff. You do a lot of good stuff, so you're a pretty lucky dude. I'm always honored to have John Lithgow on this program. His insights are always profound. I always learn something talking to him. And I go to bed at night after talking to you, I feel smarter.
I can return the compliment, Tavis.
I mean that sincerely. I feel smarter. You challenge me to reexamine assumptions, as we say, and help me to expand my inventory of ideas. So I thank you for that, sir.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Christian scholar Tunde Ajua is a driving force in the next generation of jazz artists. He's releasing an ambitious project this year. It's a trio of albums he calls the Centennial Trilogy. The project marks the 100th anniversary of the first jazz recordings.
As I said, it is an ambitious project, and we are honored to have him back on this program. My man, how you doing?
I'm great.
Good to see you, man. How's your mom and your twin brother and your grandmother and your family?
Everybody's good.
You're part of a wonderful family, man.
Thank you. I appreciate
you.
It's
a great family, man. And your uncle?
Yeah, he's great. I just saw him.
Donald Harrison Jr., the great jazz artist, is his uncle.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
I think the last time you were here, maybe you hadn't changed your name.
No, I hadn't.
You had not changed the name the last time you were here. For those who knew you as Christian Scott when you first came out, you're still Christian Scott. You've added some to your name. Yep. Tell me what you did and why you did it.
Yeah, so I always say that I completed my name by adding on Tunde and Ajua. Just to, you know, I wasn't comfortable exclusively navigating the world as Scott. Obviously, I'm a world citizen. As a jazz musician or as a practitioner in this culture of music, you get to travel the world, right? I've been touring since I was about 14 years old. And when you're in all of these different places, all of these different cultures, the way they react to our names, I learned, it gave me a different context. Mm-hmm. And so as I got older and started to tour more, maybe about 16 or 17 years old, I started to feel it when people called me Scott. Mm-hmm. It felt differently. It didn't feel like I was being called. And so I decided to complete my name by adding Atunde and Ajua. And these are names that have reverence sort of in the culture that I come from in New Orleans, Black Indian and Afro Native American culture. Mm-hmm. Obviously, my uncle has been chief. I just became chief this year. My grandfather was chief. So I wanted to sort of de-westernize my name in a way that sort of harkened to the cultural tenets that I hold dear. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to hold on to Scott, because it's also important to me that people acknowledge and reference the fact that I'm aware of, and they need to be aware of what my actual history is. Mm-hmm. Here. You know, obviously the way that we've got these surnames is kind of dense, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that wasn't a part of what I wanted to give to my children when they get here, right? And I don't necessarily know that they're going to be called Ajua. I think, you know, when I get married and find a partner and yeah. have kids, I think we'll probably mutually decide what our family name will be, and then we'll let the children determine what the naming will be. But in the interim, I'm Atunde Ajua.
So when you hear yourself introduced in that way, mm-hmm. now, referenced that way around the world, as you were starting to have some issues with Scott not mm-hmm. feeling it, to use your phrase,
yeah.
how does it feel now?
It feels amazing.
Yeah.
It feels, you know, obviously, to me, it's important to deal with the fact that we have a history that predates the American experiment, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, being a New Orleanian, this is something that's really important to people where I'm from. Mm-hmm. But because of their life realities, a lot of people are apprehensive or afraid to de-westernize their names, because a lot of times the moment that you do that, in some ways you become sort of an enemy to the state, right? Yeah. In a lot of people's mind's eye. Mm-hmm. You know, they think just general things, like if you're filling out a job application and your name is a Wolof or a Khan name, or this automatically means something, you know, you may not get a callback, as yeah. one example. So, you know, for me, it was important to make the change. It was something that I felt that I needed to do. And now when I'm called, even when I'm called Scott, it's not something that hurts. It's not something that feels strange anymore, because Atunde and Ajua exists, mm. right? But I remember even being a young person in school and they would say Scott, Christian Scott. And it would be strange, you know. Obviously, my surname is my father's name and his father's name, and I love them very much, which is part of why I kept it, mm-hmm. right? Because I love them so much. But it was time to make a move and a change to make sure that my children.
Let me ask one more question about this, because as I mentioned at the top, I know your family so well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Over the years.
Absolutely.
And if I'm getting too personal,
no.
you push me back.
No.
Don't hit me. Just push.
Yeah, you gotta just play. Oh. I just
you play me out. Pun intended. Just right, play me out. how did your family react?
You know, it's interesting. Depended on the sides of the family,
yeah.
right? Most people were really happy that I did it, but they were scared for me. Mm-hmm. You know, when I first completed my name, it was sort of a charged moment. In the jazz community, I was admonished. People tried to project me as like a nationalist or all types of things, and came to conclusions about how I am as a person that were completely unreal. And the first bit of touring that we did, there were like threats to call the a lot of times the producers and promoters of festivals and things would say that this is a threat that's happened in different places. One time I showed up to a hotel and there was like a figure that had been left on an ironing board that was like a pejorative figure of a black person with a noose around his neck that said that your name is not Atunde Ajua, it's So that was hard for the ladies in my family. I think yeah. the men were all—they all understood it. But
so obviously, I'm sorry, not to cut you off. I don't want to forget this. So when you said to the ladies, speaking of the ladies in your family,
yeah,
women in your family, they were scared. You said they were scared. They were scared for you.
Yeah,
scared for your safety.
Right.
Scared for the impact on your career.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just because you changed your name.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, even but that even happened with a lot of other musicians.
Yeah.
When they say, why would you do that? Are you crazy? Like, you'll never work again. And my thing was, is like, if this is the rationale for me not working with all of that I've sacrificed and tried to develop the acumen that I've tried to develop, what we're trying to do to reevaluate the way we communicate yeah. in this music, then I don't want to work. If that's yeah. what it is, right?
The reason why I'm pressing on this, and we'll get to the music in a second,
cool,
I promise. The reason why I'm pressing on this is because Kareem Abdul-Jabbar sat in this chair
yes,
not too long ago.
Okay.
And
I need to rub it out.
Yeah.
Well, this is really
the captain.
This is really messed you up. Muhammad Ali sat in this chair.
Okay, I'm going to take another look.
The point I'm making is that Ali changes his name, mm-hmm. and he catches all kind of Hades.
Right. Yeah.
Abdul-Jabbar changed his name. Yeah. He caught some as well. Yeah. But that was years ago.
Yeah.
I'm just surprised, I guess, on some level to hear that an artist of your note and of your stature would get that kind of pushback for, as you say, completing your name. But anyway, I just...
Well, you know, I mean, look at what just happened to LeBron's house.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, obviously there's still a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. If I'm getting personal again, tell me, and I'll put it back in.
No, it's all good.
When you first walked on this set years ago, first time I saw you, there was a young lady who came with you that day. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Esperanza,
okay. Yeah. And I want to ask, because I haven't asked, you have obviously soared to heights. She has soared to heights. Yeah. And the two of y'all were dating as kids, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And I get a kick out of that. What do you make of the success that Esperanza has had?
It's what's crazy about it.
Is that too personal?
No.
Okay.
No, not at all. What's great about it is like, I know how hard we all worked.
Yeah.
Right? I think a lot of times, you know, when people are looking at that environment, what they come up with is topical. And they like to make excuses for why she is as successful as she is, right? I've heard people say, well, she's getting it because she's beautiful. She's getting it for this reason or that reason. No, she's getting it because she works harder than everyone else, right? You know, when you fast forward and you look at like what like Robert Glasper's done or Steven Bruner and all these, I think a lot of times people don't realize that the proximity that we have to each other, like some of the greatest practitioners of this culture of music in this generation, they're all family.
Yeah.
So, and that existed in the past, but I think it's a little different in that most of us knew each other when we were children and before we could really play that well, right? So I met her when she was 17, I was 18 years old. I've known Robert since I was 14 years old, Steven since he was a little kid, you know. So when I look at that moment and I see that, obviously I have like, my heart opens up and I'm just like the proudest person on the planet, because I know, I remember when this person was 17 years old and they wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and practice for 4 or 5 hours in the day, right? Before anyone knew any of our names, right? So when you see what's grown out of that, you can't help but be proud, you know?
What's cool about that too, that's about that story, I don't mean to demonize or cast aspersion on the hip hop community, but as we all know, it can be really competitive.
Yeah.
And sometimes they get off on and they sell records based up on dissing one another.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in this jazz culture, it's much more familial and collaborative. And so it's nice to hear those stories.
Well, I think a big part of it too is, you know, I think as a cultural misnomer, what we do is about a constant reevaluation of the way that we're communicating, and we do it as a collective, right? So like, obviously, like I demo the app and play today, right? That's just me playing by myself with this template that we created. But 99% of the time when I'm playing, there's at least four other, seven, eight, nine other musicians that are also making this music. So it becomes easier to build that sort of, family type space when you have to rely on each other to actually communicate. So I think this is partly why it's a little different.
That makes sense. And the app that Christian just referenced, Don't Go Anywhere, because this thing is amazing. This app that they've created, for anybody who loves music, you're going to play with the app.
Yes, sir.
He's actually going to play with this app that he's created, so you want to stick around to hear Christian play alongside it. Now, to that point, tell me about this three-part project. This is, I said, ambitious.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So so the Centennial Trilogy. This is a document that I wanted to make to commemorate the first 100 years of this music's history, but that also looks to reevaluate the way we communicate with the listener now, right? I think for most people that enjoy jazz music or listen to this culture of music, part of what I've seen is there's this idea, sort of this notion that floats around in this culture that all of the best jazz records already exist or have already been made. And I think a lot of times, even as I say that, I can feel it dawning on people that they feel that way, right?
Do you feel that way?
I don't.
Is that intimidating?
No.
For people to even...
It's strange.
Is it intimidating for you to know that people feel that way? That the best stuff... Kind of blue, culture. That stuff's already been done.
That's weird. Actually, I never thought about that.
Yeah.
No, not really. I think, the thing for me is, it's when you think about this music, it's like any other thing. Like, you know, if you take Bob Cousy and Steph Curry and put them in a gym, my money's on Steph Curry. right? But it's mainly because Steph had the opportunity to watch Bob Cousy, mm-hmm, right?
Right.
So the music is the same, mm-hmm, right? Like, obviously, I'm the hugest Miles Davis fan you could think of, right? I obviously love Dizzy Gillespie's playing, right? But this generation has had an opportunity not only to study their contribution, mm-hmm, but to study the practitioners that studied them in the next generation, mm-hmm, and the guys the generation, mm-hmm, after that. So obviously, there's things that we have the opportunity to showcase, and we've had the opportunity to develop, mm-hmm, that they couldn't based on the time that they inherited. I think having this sort of notion that that there's a cap on what jazz has the potential to be, mm-hmm, is sort of strange to me, because it is essentially a very young form, you, mm-hmm, know. So we wanted to make these records to look at that moment, but to try and take the music into to new vernacular, to, mm-hmm, create new vernacular, new, mm-hmm, modes of operating, right? New sonic realities for the music, right? So, mm-hmm, essentially what we're also looking to do is we're trying to take all of the seemingly disparate forms of music that have grown out of jazz, right? Because you think of jazz and blues are really synonyms for, mm-hmm, each other. This is the same culture. My teachers when I was a little boy would always say that jazz was just blues that refined itself to exist in all contexts, mm-hmm, right? And blues not in terms of like melancholic woe is me music, but blues as and how I learned as a little boy in New Orleans, which is the most sincere thing that you can excavate in a moment of communicating through music, mm-hmm, is blues, mm-hmm, right? But you take jazz and blues, and eventually that evolves into what we was called race music. Mm-hmm. Then that evolved into rhythm and blues, R&B music, and that evolved into rock and roll music. So you have all of these different cultures that have grown out of jazz. Part of what we're looking to do in the Centennial Trilogy is to also go about the business of reacculturating all of those vernacular back into a creative, improvised context so that we can figure out the next century's worth of communicating.
Mm. Right? So say a word to me before you get to this demonstration of this app and your, yeah, horn. Mm. Tell me about the three parts of the,
yeah,
trilogy.
Absolutely.
First part came out in March earlier this year.
Yeah, the, right, first one is out. That one is titled Ruler Rebel, mm-hmm, right? This one is identifying who you're listening to, right? Obviously, my identity politics, being from New Orleans, mm-hmm, you know, coming up in the Afro-Native American or Black Indian culture and tradition. I just became chief of the Brave this year, and so this is a big part of my identity, mm-hmm, politics. So I wanted to start off sort of by showcasing that because it directly relates to the beginning of this music's history, right? Obviously, this is the culture that was in Congo Square when the seeds of the music were starting, right? There are documents of Louis Armstrong and Sidney Bechet and Kid Ory and Baby Dodds talking about seeing the great chiefs singing there and how some people would say that Louis's phrasing sounded like the great chiefs, right? Mm-hmm. So taking those moments and identifying who you are listening to, right? The second record is Diaspora, and I sort of mean that in the more macrocosmic sense, in that, you know, I think that this generation has a profound opportunity in front of itself. We can be the generation that eradicates a lot of these systemic and social ills and all of these things, but the way that that happens is by us looking for the sameness as opposed to constantly illuminating the differences between cultures. And so this is essentially what we do with stretch music, but the second record references that. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, we're gonna put, so there are influences in this record where you can hear rhythm like Kassa Soto or Kassa Laban from Senegal or Mali or Gambia, and that might be coupled with something that sounds like Nordic pop music, might be coupled with the harmonic type that comes from a Polish aria or something like that, right? So this record is essentially who is being spoken to, mm-hmm, and grabbing all of these different cultural elements to create a marriage of those cultures to say that we belong together, right? And then the last record is called The Emancipation Procrastination.
I love that title.
Yeah. So
Emancipation, yeah, Procrastination.
Right, yeah. And that is as real as the title is, right? Uh-huh. And deals with, you know, what we deal with not just in this country, but in the world, in terms of, you know, we have to actually really take a step back and reevaluate the way that we communicate, the way that we interact with each other, because we don't get to the place that we want to get if we're constantly fracturing, and this tribalism stops us from, mm-hmm, essentially freeing ourselves, mm, right? So the last record is essentially the message. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In a minute, tell me what you make of jazz 100 years later.
100 years later.
After this first recording.
After the first recording. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, jazz is essentially the world's first fusion music. It's the first music that actually references the fact that seemingly disparate perspectives and cultures belong in the same spaces. right? So when you look at the trajectory of how this music started, and then you look at that 100 years, and you can literally find every other form of music, every other genre of music that has ever existed on this world has a space in jazz music. Yeah, I can show you can find a jazz record that mixes polka music with jazz music. I can find a jazz record that mixes salsa music with jazz music. So when I'm looking at that history, it's hard not to, you know, for your chest to just open up and you not to be so proud, because it's essentially a music that is based in the idea that we should love each other.
Mm. This Centennial Trilogy out in various pieces this year. Mm-hmm. Pick all three of them up, and I promise you the third piece comes out in September.
Yes, sir.
I think so. Third piece on the way. But get all three before the year's over, and I think you'll be empowered, inspired, and entertained by all three. Speaking of entertaining, Christian is going to close us out with a special performance of his song Twin. I mentioned he has a twin brother.
Yeah, Kyle.
A song called Twin, using the Stretch Music app, which he's going to demonstrate for you in just a second. This is pretty amazing stuff. Mm. Check it out. Christian, love you, man.
I love you, too.
Good to see you.
The Stretch Music app is the first interactive media player of its kind. It allows you to customize your practicing or listening experience through manipulation of the stems of the tracks in the songs of Stretch Music, right? So I'll give an example of that, all right? So we're going to play a song called Twin, and I'm going to customize this guy so you can hear it. All right, here we go. So let's say you play piano and you want to learn the piano part without hearing the other instruments. Well, we have a button for that. You can solo any instrument. You can also solo groups of instruments. Right? You also have the ability to mute any instrument. So let's say you want to take the drums out and play without the rhythm section in that way. You can take a trumpet out, or you can take all the drums out, all right? You also have the ability to pan instruments from left to right, so I can move the bass to the left, the guitar to the right. It also comes with the charts for all of the instruments. So if I bring everything else back, there's also a looping function. So if I want to play a smaller passage as opposed to the entire composition, I can start a loop here, give it a bar or two, and then I can repeat that loop. So I can turn the loop off. And then the last thing that it has is tempo controlling. So let's say you can't play my tempo at first and you want to take it slower, then you can slow it down. So this is essentially what the Stretch Music app is all about.
Now let's listen to Christian perform his single, Twin.
Thank you.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.